We are assembled for the second of the spring series of 10 lectures of the Vancouver Institute being held here in the Instructional Resources Center. I would ask that anyone who has not received a brochure for this series pick one up at the desk on the way out, where we have faithful volunteers taking memberships week after week. I feel I must say a word about the opening lecture last week with Dr. Margaret Mead. Despite the heavy snow, we had an enormous turnout, a crowd of over 2,000 people, and though we fully anticipated an overflow audience, we had no way of coping with this sort of attendance. We had arranged for closed circuit TV, and I would like to assure those of you who were in either of the two rooms where breakdowns occurred that the audio-visual equipment was in working order an hour before the lecture. I can therefore only apologize to those of you who missed this singular speaker. There will be one lecture demonstration requiring a proscenium, and therefore on February 15th, the Japanese No Theater Demonstration Lecture will be held in the old UBC auditorium at the north end of the campus. I will reiterate this change of venue for the February 15th lecture only for the next 4 weeks, so that as many people as possible will be aware of that fact well in advance, and we'll advertise it, of course. This evening, we are again indebted to the Cecil and Ida Green Lecture Committee for making available to us this opportunity to hear Professor Brian Berry of Nuffield College at Oxford University. Professor Berry has a background of philosophy, economics, and political science, and has been enormously productive, having published 3 books and a great number of articles and reviews. The titles will give you some idea of his variety of expertise. One is, quote, Political Argument, written in 1965. Another, Sociologists, Economists, and Democracy, written in 1970. And the latest in 1973 being The Liberal Way of Justice. Professor Berry is also the founding editor of the British Journal of Political Science. One can truly say that he works at the borderlines of philosophy, economics, and the social and political sciences, reflecting the unusual versatility and range of his interests. Tonight he will speak on the problems of social justice. Dr. Brian Berry.
This doohickey down here.
It's just right here. Sorry about that. Right.
Sorry.
Don't right. Raise that too low.
Yeah, probably.
If you pull, I'm going to do this.
Okay. Okay, it's
is
probably
that right,
isn't it? Yeah.
Is that all right?
Yeah. Well, tell me whether I'm audible. Okay, well, by social justice, we mean the question whether the advantages and disadvantages or the benefits and burdens, the claims or liabilities within a society are distributed in the right kind of way. And the problem of social justice, considered philosophically, is essentially the question, what are the criteria for ascribing social justice or social injustice to some society? Obviously, there are all kinds of more practical problems than this, how to actually achieve social justice in a given society, but even the possibility of asking such questions presupposes that we've already got some answer to the philosophical question. So I shall this evening stick to this more philosophical level of analysis, which I think is quite enough to be going on with. And this is especially so because I've actually rather oversimplified the philosophical problem by saying that it's the question, what are the right criteria? Because, of course, we're not simply interested in producing answers to this question, we're also interested in asking why something counts as an answer. So to the question, what are the criteria for ascribing social justice in a society, there corresponds a further question, second order question, how do you know that? What are the grounds for saying that something's a criterion of justice or, for that matter, of any other value? Well, pretty clearly there's a threat of an infinite regress opening up here, and I don't want to get into that. And in fact, I shall keep this second order question, how do we know the answer, somewhat in the background, but it can't be ignored completely. Well, now, I don't intend to burden you tonight with a historical account of the development of ideas of social justice, but I would just like to mention that Aristotle, about 2,500 years ago, seems to me to have said an awfully large amount of what's true on the subject that anybody has ever said. And I think this, in some ways, has presented a problem for subsequent political philosophers. Brahms, when he was asked by somebody why he was taking so long to finish his first symphony, pointed to a bust of Beethoven on the piano and said, "You can't imagine what it's like having him looking over your shoulder." And I think a lot of subsequent philosophers have rather been worried by the same problem. Aristotle's basic ideas about social justice, I'd just like to say a word about. His idea essentially was that justice is a kind of equality, or more precisely, an equality of ratios, in other words, proportionality. And the mathematical apparatus that he had for talking about this in terms of the lengths of segments of lines was pretty inadequate, but I think that the idea comes across adequately enough. First of all, then, the notion is that there are characteristics of people which given individuals have or don't have, and they have in greater or lesser amounts, intelligence, virtue, contribution to others in the society, breeding in the sense of aristocratic versus plebeian birth, race, ethnic group, age, sex, all that kind of thing. Secondly, some of these characteristics are chosen as the bases for allocating advantages or disadvantages, benefits and burdens, and so on. And what this means is that the distribution of the characteristics that are chosen as bases should in some way be parallel, should correspond to the distribution of advantages and disadvantages in the society. And that was the notion of essentially of justice that he put forward. Now, he doesn't seem to have thought there was very much that could be usefully said about the second order question, which in this theory obviously becomes the question, what are the grounds for choosing bases for allocating advantages and disadvantages between different people? He seems to have believed much more that his role was to describe the way in which people thought about these matters in as analytically clear a way as possible, rather than to go behind them and ask whether these beliefs were right or wrong. And this, I must say, is a view which I have a good deal of sympathy. He did, however, offer some observations of what you might call a sociological kind about ascriptions of justice. First of all, he pointed out that there's a general agreement that justice does consist in there being the right proportion between the score that people have on some characteristic and the allocation of disadvantages, of advantages and disadvantages on that, and that disagreements center around the question, what are the characteristics that should be the bases for allocating advantages and disadvantages? And he pointed out that there's some tendency for the choice of characteristics to be systematically related to people's social position. That is to say, those who are already in an advantaged position tend to emphasize those characteristics that would underwrite such a position. Others advocate claims based on alternative characteristics that, if they were accepted, would put them ahead. And Aristotle also noted what's since become a quite widely held doctrine, the egalitarian idea that the only characteristic that should be relevant for the allocation of many advantages and disadvantages is the factor that people have in common, the factor of common humanity, so that everyone who satisfies the conditions for being a human being should have the same rights. Of course, this still leaves open the question what constitutes a human being for this purpose. And Aristotle, of course, reflected the common assumptions in ruling out slaves, and similarly the rights proclaimed by the Declaration of Independence in the USA were understood from the start not to extend to the Negro slaves. Now, I mention Aristotle here not as a historical curiosity, but because I do think that a very large proportion of what's been said on the subject that's true was in fact said by Aristotle. And this is, of course, quite hard for political philosophers subsequently to swallow. And I think that one can say of the later developments what A. Hausmann once wrote in a celebrated critical review, when he said, "There's much that is new and much that is true in this book, but what is new is not true, and what is true is not new." Well, now, as I said, I'm not proposing to run through the history of speculations about social justice from the time of Aristotle to the present day, and instead I plan to close in on the last few years, because the subject has, I think, been shaken up considerably by the contribution of Professor John Rawls of Harvard University in his book, A Theory of Justice, which was published in 1971. And the intellectual impact of this book is, I think, itself quite a phenomenon. It's been taken up not just by philosophers, but also economists and lawyers, for example. And the critical literature, to which I plead guilty to having contributed some, has already developed in considerable bulk. And I think this does raise the question why this should be, because I think it is quite a phenomenon. And I think the answer is that it flows from the significance of the claim that's made by Rawls for his theory. He maintains that he can deduce the criteria of social justice from a certain construction which doesn't itself contain ethical judgments. And the attempt to do this might be said to constitute the search for the moral philosopher's stone, so that if Rawls had succeeded, I think it really would be news. And I think this is why it's worth paying attention to the claims that he makes and to ask whether we think that they're right. So in terms of the discussion with which I began, this means that Rawls has got both a theory of justice, that is to say a view about what the criteria of justice are, and he's also got a second-order theory, that is to say he's got a theory about the way in which the criteria of justice can be derived and the way in which they can be defended. And let me say a little bit first about the second-order theory, the theory about how we find out what the criteria of justice are. The idea here is that our views of justice are inevitably liable to be biased by our particular position in society. In other words, we're liable to bend the criteria of justice that we adhere to so as to justify an excessive advantage to ourselves. And Rawls's answer to this problem is to say, imagine the members of some society are taken behind what he calls a veil of ignorance, which really means that they're exposed to some form of selective amnesia. And behind this veil of ignorance, in what he calls the original position, they don't know their abilities, their tastes, occupations, their position in the social structure. They don't know what country they live in, or they don't even know what time period they're living in. The only thing that they do know about themselves is that they're members of the same society, and apart from that, they have some general information about the characteristics of human beings. They know that human beings are creatures that have wants, that they attach considerable importance to carrying out some kind of plan of life, and so on. Well, what happens then? According to Rawls, these people are to pick the general principles which are going to be appealed to in the future, when they return to the actual society, whatever it may be that they live in, the principles that are to be appealed to regulate their life together. And he then suggests that whatever principles these people come up with in the original position to regulate their life together in society will necessarily be principles of justice. Now, I want to pause here for a moment because this last move is a big one, and it takes us way beyond the simple idea that moral judgments require impartiality. This is an idea that's often been put forward by philosophers and indeed seems to me fairly non-contentious. For example, it's been put forward in the form of the so-called ideal observer theory, the idea that that moral judgments are those judgments that might be made by somebody who was detached from any particular interest in a society, who was looking on it from the outside and thinking about what ought to be done. That seems to me fine, but it's one thing to say that if we want to know about justice, we ought to take people behind this veil of ignorance and ask them to try and agree about what are the criteria for justice. That seems to me perfectly okay. And the whole business of the veil of ignorance, the notion of people being exposed to this selective amnesia, can simply then be regarded as a dramatic way of making this point. But it's quite another thing to say that whatever they agree to is going to be called by us justice, particularly if we include the idea that they're not, so to speak, trying to be just, but they're trying to do as well for themselves as possible. Well, now, let's press on anyway and see how this works. The obvious question is, how are these creatures, given their almost entire ignorance, supposed to set about making the decision? Well, the problem may appear pretty determinate. I mean, we've taken away almost all the grounds on which one would normally try to base any decision, and we're asking them to take extremely fundamental decisions. And so on that basis, we might say, well, the whole problem is impossible. Rawls makes it more determinate by adding the postulate, though, that the people who are doing this are self-interested. This is what really gives the theory some definite form. Now, again, it may appear difficult to make sense of this in this original position, because the usual idea, of course, of somebody being self-interested is that he pursues his own interests. He tries to get hold of as much as possible of what he wants. But if you don't know what you want, then you don't seem to have the basic information on which you can pursue your own interests. Well, Rawls suggests that the way out of this is to say that pursuing your interests from behind the veil of ignorance means trying to ensure as good a chance as possible of getting what you want when you emerge into the real world, whatever it may turn out that you do actually want. And there are certain limitations on choice which are built in by Rawls, although these are not supposed to be assumptions about what your actual wants will be when you emerge. The first assumption is that there's no benevolence. That is to say, you don't have the idea in the original position that what you may want is to make other people happy. Your own happiness depends, so to speak, on what you get and not what other people get. Conversely, there's no envy. That is to say, we exclude the idea that you may be made miserable by knowing that you're worse off than other people. And finally, there are no wants in general for a particular distribution of income or more generally for any particular state of society. So that self-interest in this context doesn't simply mean the general idea of pursuing the object of giving yourself as much chance as possible of achieving any goal that you may have, but of achieving a certain range of goals, namely those goals that don't depend intrinsically on how well off other people are. And so this is rather like the assumption that's made in a lot of economic theory, that the utility derived by a consumer is a function only of the goods that he himself consumes. And in both cases, the justification that's offered is that this gets the construction off the ground and makes it possible to say something determinate. But at the same time, we have to notice that it biases the whole analysis towards a certain kind of individualism. The image is of, if you like, a sort of autistic society in which each person is concerned only with what he gets, and cooperation takes place only to the extent that each party sees it as a way of increasing what he or she gets, so that distributive justice is then imposed on such a society as a way of regulating what people get, but it can't grow out of the structure of the actual relationships between people. Well, so we have these people behind a veil of ignorance, which excludes particular information that about themselves, and they're choosing in a self-interested way, in the way that I've just described. And what they're choosing are the principles on which their life together is to be regulated. So the question then is, what will they decide? And there are two stages in this process of choice that are put forward by Rawls. The first is, on the basis of this sketchy knowledge that we've attributed to them about what it is that they want, that is to say, simply the knowledge that they know they've got some wants, they know that they attach importance to carrying out plans, then he argues that they'll agree that the important question is the way that certain indispensable means to these ends are distributed. And these indispensable means are called by Rawls primary goods, and they include things like wealth and power, individual liberty, and self-respect. And whatever you want, whatever plans you may have, it must be desirable, it's suggested, to have more of these primary goods rather than less of them. And so therefore, the people who are choosing principles from behind this veil of ignorance will agree to express these principles in terms of the distribution of these primary goods. And so then the second question is obviously, well, how are these primary goods to be distributed? What rule would be drawn up from behind this veil of ignorance about the way in which these primary goods are to be distributed? And there's one obvious principle that immediately presents itself, that is to say, to maximize the average amount for each. Since it's already been supposedly established that more of each of them is better than less, then if people are choosing in a self-interested way, shouldn't each person simply choose a principle from behind the veil of ignorance that the society as a whole should have as much per capita of each of these primary goods? The obvious rationale of this is that in the absence of any particular information about yourself, the amount that you can expect to get yourself is maximized by the choice of this principle. There's no way of doing better on the average for yourself than to say that the average for everybody should be maximized. Well, obviously, there'd have to be some kind of rule for what you do if you have to choose between more of one of these primary goods and more of the other. There'd have to be some sort of way of trading off one primary good against another and so on. But we needn't go into that. The basic idea would be that whenever you can increase the overall amount per capita of one of the primary goods without decreasing the amount of any of the others, then doing so would represent for the society an improvement. And I'm suggesting that this would be a pretty obvious rule to choose. And Rawls argues against this. He asks you to imagine yourself as one of these people behind the veil of ignorance, and you're asked to think about emerging from behind it and resuming your usual place in the world. And suppose then that you find that the way that the application of this rule, maximizing the average amount of the primary goods worked out, was to produce a society with very great inequalities. And suppose that you turned out to be one of the people at the bottom of the heap. Would you be willing to accept that it was justified for you to have extremely few primary goods because other people had a very large amount, and that that distribution was the way to maximize the average? And Rawls suggests that you wouldn't be at all pleased about that, and that the contemplation of the prospect of turning out like that would weigh with you in the original position, and would therefore lead you to fight shy of the principle of maximizing the average, and would lead you instead to go for something more cautious. So what would this be? Well, what he comes up with is the suggestion that you would go for two principles, what he calls two principles of justice. The first of these is that you would aim for universal rights to free speech, personal liberty, protection from arbitrary punishments, in other words, equality before the law, that kind of thing, universal suffrage, political rights, and so on. That's the first principle. The second principle is that you would aim to arrange the distribution of the material primary goods, that is to say, the distribution of things like wealth and power, so that the person who got the least would get as much as he possibly could. In other words, starting from a position of equality, you would allow some people to get more than that, if and only if things could be arranged so that some benefit would go to the rest of the society. For example, so that the income that this person was allowed to earn could be taxed partially so as to provide some public benefit that could be distributed among other people. And Rawls also says that the first principle has priority over the second. And what this means is that if a choice has to be made between implementing the first principle and implementing the second, then the first should be pursued at the cost of the second. Concretely, then, what this comes to is that the pursuit of equal liberty should come before improving the position of the worst off member of the society. And the rationale for all of this is the same, that the most important of all the primary goods is self-respect, and that the maintenance of self-respect is intrinsically related to the ability to carry out your plans. And the argument is that self-respect will be served by equality of civil and political rights, whereas with wealth and power, the only thing that matters is how much you yourself have. He does actually qualify this at one point by admitting that maybe beyond some point, material inequalities might start to attack the self-respect of those at the bottom, but he doesn't make very much of this, and it's never formally incorporated in the statement of the second principle. And the same point about the greater importance of self-respect than the other primary goods also underwrites the priority of the first principle over the second. The idea is supposed to be that the importance to people's plans from being able to pursue them by means of the use of civil and political rights is greater than the importance to people's carrying out people's plans that's attributable to material prosperity and so on. I've attempted very briefly to set out and to explain Rawls's theory of justice. Anyone in the audience who's familiar with it, and I know a number of people are, will recognize that I've left out a lot of detail, but the book is about as long as one of the longer novels of Charles Dickens, and the plot is at least as complicated, so I'm afraid that that's unavoidable. But I hope that I've at least succeeded in putting over the main ideas in it, if I may, I'll just run over these again. The first is that what would be chosen by self-interested people from behind a veil of ignorance are necessary principles, are necessarily principles of justice. The second is what we might call the anti-gambling motif, the idea that those who were doing the choosing wouldn't go, as one might perhaps expect, for making the average as high as possible, but would be particularly concerned to avoid a very bad outcome, and they therefore want to adopt a principle with a special eye on those who did worst. And the third is the idea of the particular importance that Rawls says would be attached by the people who were choosing principles from behind the veil of ignorance to self-respect and to those aspects of one's plans that require acting on one's beliefs, sort of doing things rather than receiving things, as it were. And so finally, putting these last two together, the conclusion is that what would be chosen would be two principles: equal liberty as the criterion for civil and political rights, and making the worst off person as well off as possible as the criterion for the distribution of wealth and power. And also the conclusion that the first principle would have priority over the second. Now, obviously, there's almost an embarrassingly wide range of points at which we might question this theory. We can get some kind of system into thinking about this by thinking in terms of more or less fundamental levels of criticism. At the most fundamental level, we can criticize the first of the statements, which I put in the summary. If we conclude that what would be chosen in the Rawlsian original position doesn't necessarily have anything to do with justice, then obviously this undercuts the other points, because then what they would or wouldn't choose, while perhaps interesting for some purposes, becomes of no significance from the point of view of social justice. The next most fundamental level would be to accept the idea that what would be chosen in the original position should be taken to constitute principles of justice, but to question the anti-gambling idea. In other words, you might say that there's no adequate argument advanced in a theory of justice for the view that it would not be rational to choose to maximize the average position. Less fundamental still would be to accept both the idea that what would be chosen should be taken as principles of justice and the idea that it would be rational to pay particular attention to making the position of the worst off member of society as attractive as possible, but you could still then question whether the relative importance of the primary goods is really the way that Rawls depicts it, and whether the implication is that improving the position of the worst off member of the society as much as it can be done really does entail the two principles of justice and the relation that he postulates between them. Well, I'll be very happy afterwards to answer any questions that people have about my own views about these, and to discuss any comments that people may have about the linkages in the theory. But since the time is obviously limited, I want to skip fairly briefly over the less fundamental levels and cut straight to the most fundamental one, the question whether the whole construction itself really tells us about social justice. So let me just say about the other levels that I do think that there are problems at each stage. Thus, starting with the least fundamental level, the priority of liberty over material benefits, it seems to me to presuppose that the people who are doing the choosing in the original position have information about the structure of human desires that simply is not, as a matter of fact, in general correct. My impression is that most people are prepared to trade off liberty to do the things that they want to do against material benefits if that choice has to be made. And if that's true, then it would seem to follow that the people in the original position shouldn't choose to give liberty absolute priority. We have to remember here that these people in the original position are simply ourselves. They're simply ordinary people who have forgotten things about themselves and are trying to do as well for themselves as is possible in the circumstance. So it wouldn't be relevant to say here, well, even if they don't, people ought to place an absolute value on liberty vis-a-vis any material benefit. I mean, that maybe in other contexts is a perfectly valid thing to argue, but in the context of Rawls' theory, it's quite irrelevant. It's importing a quite different kind of idea from any that he wants to make use of. Well, that's the least fundamental level. Again, at the next level, I don't believe that the arguments that Rawls adduces are sufficient to yield the conclusion that the people who are choosing from behind the veil of ignorance should be particularly concerned at the prospect of being among the worst off members of the society. It does seem to me that if all we put into the situation is a self-interested choice under conditions of uncertainty, then it seems to me that there are really only two plausible lines that we can take. The first is to say simply that the notion of self-interest is inadequately specified, it has insufficient content to enable us to say how one should set about choosing principles at all. The situation as described is simply too indeterminate to enable an answer to be derived. That's one possible answer. Alternatively, I think if we do think that it's possible to say anything, then I really think that in the absence of any specific reason for doing anything else, the only sensible thing to do is to choose a rule that will maximize the expected advantage to oneself. In other words, to maximize in a statistical sense the expected value of the outcome. And that would clearly mean picking the rule that the average person is to be made as well off as possible. This leaves open the question exactly what well-offness is taken to in herein. I think that in order to get the conclusions that he wants to, Rawls would have to show that for some reason people in the original position have an extreme aversion to risk, but he explicitly denies that an assumption like this can be imported into the theory, and I think he's quite right to deny it. Well, all this is perhaps in some sense a matter of nuts and bolts. Maybe the conclusions don't follow from the premises, but perhaps we could wheel on some other premises from which these conclusions would follow, or alternatively, from these premises we could derive some slightly different conclusions that would follow. But the fundamental question still remains whether the whole underlying idea of the construction is itself sound. And it's that question that I want to take up in a little more detail in the rest of this lecture. Now, there are two aspects of the notion of the choice in the original position that have to be distinguished here. The first, as I said, is simply the idea that of a choice to be made under conditions that prevent people from pursuing their own particular interests. This seems to me entirely unacceptable, and from this point of view we can simply regard the construction of the veil of ignorance as a dramatic way of bringing out the point that moral choices should never be self-serving, but there's nothing particularly distinctive or, I think, controversial about it. What's, I think, much more dubious is the second aspect of the choice in the original position, the notion that it should be a self-interested choice. And the general line of objection to this is that there simply doesn't seem to be any a priori reason why a self-interested choice, under whatever constraints of information we like to introduce, should constitute a morally binding set of principles to regulate social relationships. Rawls doesn't, in my view, offer an adequate rationale, and yet I don't myself see any alternative rationale to the one that he does offer. The explanation offered by Rawls is that the condition of self-interested choice represents the conditions under which questions of justice arise in an actual society. Well, of course, it's true that if everyone were sufficiently benevolent, although not too benevolent, there might be no problem of distribution in a society, because it's possible then that everybody would agree spontaneously on some distribution, and this distribution would satisfy all of them at once. And in that case, I suppose the question of what is a just distribution wouldn't arise, because what everybody actually wanted as the thing he would most like in the universe would coincide. And so therefore, there'd never be any need to adjudicate between conflicting wants, which is the role of a conception of justice in a society, as Rawls argues, I think, correctly. But none of this, I think, goes to prove that the criteria of justice must be what would be chosen when everybody was trying to do as well as possible for himself and was restrained only by lack of information from cooking the criteria to suit his own personal circumstances. We could say instead that the necessity for a conception of distributive justice arises, no doubt, because of the limited benevolence of most human beings, and that the criteria of justice are those that would be chosen by people from behind a veil of ignorance. We could follow that far. We could then say the criteria of justice are those that would be chosen from behind a veil of ignorance by people who were trying to decide what would be the just way to settle conflicts of interest. Or leaving aside the dramaturgy of the original position, we could simply say that the principles of justice are those principles that would be chosen by people who were personally disinterested and who were trying to come up with principles of justice. Now, of course, I admit that there's a certain circularity in this, but I suggest that maybe that's unavoidable. If we leave justice out of the premise, maybe there's no way to get it into the conclusions. Well, that's the general argument, which simply says that there's no a priori reason, as far as I can see, why a self-interested choice should be counted as a criterion of justice. But there's also a more specific line of argument to the effect that there are definite reasons for not expecting a self-interested choice to correspond to our normal understanding of the concept of justice. If you're thinking in self-interested terms, it seems plausible to say that since you're only interested in how much you get, you must be interested simply in trying to maximize the amount or trying to make sure that the minimum amount you're guaranteed is as large as possible or some kind of variant on that sort of aim. And if that's so, then I think this must direct your choice of principles for social distribution towards principles that are expressed in terms of the average amount people get, the minimum amount anybody gets, and that sort of thing. And yet, if you were asking yourself in as detached a way as possible how benefits ought to be distributed in a society, you might very well come up with quite different criteria. You might think, for example, that somebody who had contributed something conspicuous to the welfare of others, say, somebody who invented penicillin or something like that, should get some reward. And you might think that this, quite apart from any notion, that the way to encourage people to do things of a beneficial kind is to reward them. You might simply say that someone who did something outstandingly beneficial to others deserved to be rewarded in some way, and that that was what justice required. Now, I think the point to notice here is that you could scarcely come up with such a principle by making a self-interested choice from the original position. From that point of view, the only way to approach it would be to ask, what are the chances of your turning out to be the man or the woman who discovered penicillin? And in the absence of any special information about yourself, then that's simply as much chance as anybody else in the original position has of being the man or woman who discovers penicillin. So if we admit, if we leave out the idea that the reward is supposed to be for having discovered penicillin, then it's merely a shot of one in a few billion that you will get a reward. And so therefore the question reduces to the form, would you like there to be a lottery of one in n billion for a reward of such and such a size to be distributed? And so therefore we're immediately back at looking at distributions rather than at specific things about people that might justify their getting more or less. And so with this I come back to where I started, and let me just remind you again of Aristotle's conception of justice, that it's a matter of matching the distribution of rewards to the distribution of some characteristics that are regarded as forming a basis for differential rewards. And it's that notion, I think, that inevitably gets lost in the Rawlsian construction. And I think it's for that reason that no amount of revision of it can succeed while leaving the central idea intact. If we start from the idea that the criteria of justice are those principles that would be chosen by self-interested actors from behind a veil of ignorance, then I don't think we'll ever be able to arrive at anything recognizable as a principle of justice.
As Professor Berry indicated, he would be happy to have questions from the audience. Yes, Dr. Weber. Would you like to repeat that, because it's...
Why don't you go?
You suggested that anti-gambling that Professor Rawls speaks of might conflict with the logic
of being in that
situation. Just desserts.
Yeah. Well, I would like to demonstrate. But let us suppose that there were not automobiles for everybody to have one, then obviously one would be happy with a system that would provide everyone with one. On the other hand, the situation was such that what it would assure me of was a left rear wheel, then I would be in the position where I would elect to gamble. Now, since I don't know that is, whether there is enough of liberty or automobiles, I'm in the position where I would be gambling in any case by the choice I made. You follow? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, I think that you've put the point very well. It's... Pardon? I think that the answer is that Rawls does seem to build into the argument the notion that the minimum amount which can be provided to everyone is materially adequate. In other words, that you wouldn't finish up with merely a rear right-hand wheel. Now, as far as I can see, there's no justification offered for that belief. The people in the original position are not supposed to know how wealthy their society is. And so I think that that's an illegitimate move. I suppose the argument is nevertheless that you would be concerned with not falling below an extremely minimal position, and so therefore, even if the society. Well, I think that there isn't any adequate argument in the thing to, for saying why you wouldn't gamble. There are a number of reasons put forward which purport to show why there is something special about this kind of choice, which ought to lead you to an extremely conservative choice, but I don't think that these do in fact follow. And I think that most of them do depend on a particular idea about everybody being able to be brought up above some threshold of a satisfactory level of existence. And I think that is, in a sense, built into the argument. Well, yeah.
I was wondering if you would comment on whether or not the professor encompasses in his theory the temporal factor, and that the immediate distribution may be equal but unequal in terms of future generations, and whether that is a factor in the concept of social justice.
Yes, this is a question that's addressed. It turns out, I think, to be rather difficult from the point of view of the theory. If you apply strictly the notion of making the worst off as well off as they ever can be, then the conclusion is that you would never have any investment, because the first generation, as it were, would have to make themselves worse off than they are to begin with in order to invest for the future, and this therefore makes them worse off than subsequent generations, so therefore they shouldn't invest, so therefore the next generation is the first generation and therefore they shouldn't invest, and so on indefinitely. And I think that this probably is actually the logical conclusion of the theory, the more I think about it. But Rawls is reluctant to admit this, and therefore he tries to argue that you would, in the original position, try to think about what you would like the rate of savings to be. And I think that he doesn't really produce any very good arguments for how you would determine that.
Dr. Vogt?
Let's take a simple example. At your institution, Oxford, all of the professors get exactly the same salary. At our institution here, the salary is driven by one factor of 2 or more. If you put them all behind the veil of ignorance, which do you think they would choose?
That's a nice one.
You
repeat that.
You want the question to be repeated? the question is based on the incorrect assumption that people at Oxford are paid the same amount. What is actually the case is that at the University of Oxford, people are paid in accordance with their age. So it's actually a gerontocracy rather than a meritocracy. That's really the difference. And personally, I'm against that. But yes, professors are all paid the same amount. That is perfectly true. That is perfectly true. I think that obviously this throws you right back at the question of the decision under ignorance. I mean, if you knew how you were going to turn out in the distribution of whatever it may be. I mean, I wouldn't hazard a guess that makes people get paid more than others here. Then, obviously, you would decide accordingly. In the absence of that, then, obviously, you would go for everybody being paid the same. And presumably, also, of course, I think there would be an argument there if it's simply a fixed amount which is to be divided in alternative ways, so that there's no question, if you're not worried about any notion of incentive effects, which the system here may have and the system at Oxford not have, if you're not worried about that, then of course I think that there might be an argument in any case for paying everybody the same, if you believe in the notion of the diminishing marginal utility of money. In other words, if you think that the marginal dollar brings less happiness to people the further up the income distribution you go, then that again would be an argument for equality. The problem with Rawls's theory, of course, is that it isn't simply a matter of a fixed amount that's to be divided up, because he assumes that the problem is complicated by the fact that you may have to pay people more in order to try to get them to do things which will then be socially beneficial and will redound to the benefit of other people. So I think that's what makes the thing complicated. Without that, I think that you could actually produce, even on his own premises, a perfectly reasonable argument in terms of the average. Justice, yeah.
Social justice. Well, he makes a difficult subject more difficult, but if we're looking for consolation, I like that veil of ignorance because we're all blind. But if we're looking for some consolation, this is the anniversary of Robert's words, and the goal I think we all should strive for is to be brothers, be the world over. And if we're going to look for social justice, let's try and be more kindly towards each other and a little more sympathetic to ourselves and not so critical as the university people are to each other.
Question over here.
Yeah.
I'm a little surprised that a political science philosopher from Oxford seems to be swimming around about the exquisite of society. It would seem to me that the social scientists can give us a clue in that we are a social animal, and that the orientation in the village, where each member of the village is concerned what he can contribute to the village, doesn't induce the question of a selfish or unbenevolent advantage seeking. An example, if you like, would be the Eskimo hunter who brings a seal bag in the dead of winter to his little cluster hut. There's no moral there about being benevolent or greedy or gluttonous. This is the contribution the individual makes, and I think that isn't this argument you've been giving us tonight rather antiquated in terms of the mess that our acquisitive society has got itself into?
Yes, yes, okay. Yes, well, the question is, I think, whether the whole notion of social justice that I've been talking about itself depends on the assumptions of an acquisitive society. Obviously, there are examples of societies where the question doesn't arise in the same form, and you gave the example of an Eskimo who brings back a seal or whatever and divides it up. And I think it's perfectly true. This is actually a point that I did cover in passing, the notion that the problem of social justice occurs only where people are not willing, so to speak, spontaneously or as the result of some social norm that is not expressed in terms of justice, to behave in a way that everybody accepts. Now, I think that the particular theory that I was discussing, the theory of Rawls, does peculiarly depend on the assumptions of an acquisitive society, because built into it is a very strong assumption that the only way in which you can ever get people to do things is to offer them more material rewards. And so the whole justification for any kind of differentials is in terms of incentives that it's supposed you have to offer people in order to get them to do things. And I think that this is obviously, in my view, a reflection of a particular kind of society, and the idea that this forms the basis of a universal social theory is clearly false. And I think that this is a general problem with the whole theory of justice put forward by Rawls, that it's put forward as a universal theory, whereas in fact it reflects the assumptions of a particular kind of society. And as far as the substantive question is concerned that you're asking, I think, whether it would be possible in a large-scale society to get rid of all problems of justice and to get people, so to speak, spontaneously to behave in what you might call a socially responsible way. This seems to me more dubious. I mean, I would take it that your case of an Eskimo is one where you're talking about a fairly small community among whom the things would be divided. And I would guess myself, obviously here we're into very large questions about the possibilities of human nature and so on, but I would guess myself that it would not be possible in a mass society to achieve that kind of relationship. Yeah, well, that's certainly true. Yeah.
Well, we're driven then to go back to basic human values as we are told by the anthropologists and social scientists. These, that we're naturally a social animal. So that if we reconstruct a society, surely this is a valid place to begin.
Yes, well, I think I would accept that, but I think I would still believe that these general problems of social justice, that questions of the way in which advantages and disadvantages should be distributed within a large society, or for that matter, I would say, on a worldwide basis, still remain. I think that those problems would not be removed by any kind of development of community.
Dr. Keane?
Yes, Professor Barry, you've spelled out briefly Aristotle's theory of social justice. You commented on Rawls' theory of social justice. Give us a thumbnail sketch of Barry's theory of social justice.
Yes, well, pleasure. Yes, the question is, what's my theory of social justice? I think that in terms of the analysis of the concept, I would modestly go along with Aristotle. That's to say, it does seem to me that the general notion is very much as I described it, and indeed perhaps it's more of a question whether it was really Aristotle's. But now the question, therefore, becomes what are, in fact, the relevant criteria for distributing things among people? And I would certainly myself take for many things what I call the egalitarian view. That's to say, it seems to me that most of the characteristics of people that have been put forward in history as reasons for treating people differently in terms of sex, race, religion, and so on, don't seem to me to be good reasons for treating people differently. And so, therefore, I would say that for many purposes, people should be treated the same and should be given the same advantages and disadvantages. Over and above that, I think that the example that I gave of somebody who contributes markedly to the welfare of other people, deserving some kind of recognition, which I think it would be legitimate for it to take the form of some material advantage and not merely praise and so on. I think I would stick with that. I think that's about it.
Yes. And ask which of today's societies exemplifies social justice the best.
Well, leaving out account Canada, of course, I suppose the implication of the kind of thing that I was arguing would probably result in one's coming up with one of these Scandinavian countries, I would say. Well, I think perhaps that they're opposite sides of the same coin. That social justice is primarily about what you ought to get, what you ought to receive. Social obligation is what about what you ought to do and what you ought to contribute. And I mean, I think the point that I was making in reply to one of the earlier questions is that I think that some social problems can be solved by people doing things out of a sense of social obligation, and that this is one of the ways in which I think that Rawls's theory is too rigid, in that it assumes that the only way of ever getting somebody to do something is in effect by bribing them to do it. Well, I think that's an interesting comparison, because I suppose that the question is, if we were taken and put behind a veil of ignorance, we probably wouldn't be able to come up with the principles of calculus, and so maybe the problem with social justice is, I take it, you know, that we're just not smart enough and we haven't cracked it yet. Well, I think that this does precisely raise the question, which is, I think, that Rawls's kind of construction does assume the problem is rather like that of coming up with the principles of calculus. And I don't think that the point that we would not personally be able to come up with the principles really reflects this, because of course the question is not what people would actually do. I mean, if you can imagine the situation at all, if they were put behind this veil of ignorance, but the question is supposed to be what people would rationally do, which immediately carries the thing out of the realm of some sort of empirical prediction. And if, I mean, presumably the point about calculus or any kind of thing like that is that any competent person who studies the subject long enough and has some sort of minimal intelligence can be taught the principles and can be taught to see them. And so therefore, it wouldn't be necessary for us individually to be able to work out the principles of justice from scratch, provided that if somebody showed them to us and produced the arguments, we would be able to see them. And the question is precisely, I think, whether there is, if you like, a science of ethics similar to the science of natural phenomena. And Rawls's theory is, I think, perhaps in a way, an attempt to construct a science of ethics of this kind. He does actually talk at one point about constructing a moral geometry, which is, you know, very close to your question. And I think that what I'm arguing is that this is not, in fact, a good analogy, that it isn't possible to turn the question of social justice or any other kind of moral question, I believe, into this kind of deductive argument. And yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, can I? Yeah. Or Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that the... I'll paraphrase the question. I think the first part of the question was what's the point of the election? I think that's a very fair question. In a sense, I admit that it leaves us pretty much where we were when we started, but Wittgenstein said that philosophy leaves everything as it was before, so I'm not too worried about that. I think that the point that I was trying to make about the original position does tie up precisely with what you were saying. In other words, suppose that you've got, as you were saying, two people who disagree about something. I mean, they've got to divide a cake or something, and each of them wants an amount such that the two amounts that they want add up to more than the size of the cake. And so the question is, what's an equitable way, if you like, of dividing it up? I mean, this question immediately then arises because of this disagreement. And the point that you were saying is, well, you might bring in an arbitrator who would presumably listen to the cases that these two people put forward and then decide. Well, now, this is precisely, I think, the notion of the ideal observer. This is somebody who is detached. He has no interest, let's say, in who gets the shares of the cake. I mean, there's no question he's going to get a share of the cake. It's got to be divided between these two people, so you bring in a third person, and he thinks about it. And really, Rawls's notion of putting people in the original position, putting them behind this veil of ignorance, what this means is precisely that you try to do that without bringing in a third party. What you do is you remove from these two people any knowledge of their particular characteristics, so that if the argument was, well, I'm more hungry, so I should get a bigger share of the cake, or I'm more deserving, so I should get a bigger share of the cake, you remove from them their particular characteristics, so that they don't know that one's hungry or one has particular merits or something like that. And then you ask them to say, well, now, bearing in mind that one of you may be hungrier, or one of you may be more meritorious, or something like that, what do you think would be the right principles on which to divide the cake up? And that's really what the question is supposed to be.
Here's someone.
We have an illustration in our British Columbia history of Sir Matthew Begbie, our first judge. A brother came to him and said, will you help me? My brother is dividing the inheritance, giving himself all the best land. So Begbie said to the aggressor, he said, you divide the land and let your brother take the first pick.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, this is
behind the veil of ignorance because he didn't know which piece he was going to get.
Yes. Well, this certainly is a way, if you like, of cashing in on people's self-interest, because if the brother who's doing the choosing does as well for himself as he can, he will divide it exactly equally, won't he? Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
I find myself getting increasingly unhappy as the time has gone on, because it seems to me that when you started talking about social justice, I had the feeling you were going to talk about what society and people were all about. And in the end, it came down to being both, I think, from your viewpoint and from Rawls's viewpoint, a matter of how do we just materially handle this mess that we're in. And you, for example, your use of the penicillin example, didn't you seem to associate yourself with Rawls that the only satisfactory version of reward would be a material reward rather than respect? Now, specifically in Rawls' Primary Goods, you've got a mixture of things which are sort of apples and oranges. For example, material goods may be limited, wealth may be limited. Power, though, once you get to power, this is something that is not a material thing quite in the same sense as wealth or material goods. And especially when you get to self-respect, then you're into something which perhaps you and I, by working on each other, can mutually increase our self-respect in a marvelous way, so that self-respect can be positively fed back and increased almost without limit. Now, throughout history, it seems to me, there has been a whole set of religions which have, and including communism, which have addressed themselves to the idea that you should expect from society what only what you need, so to speak, and you should give to society what you're capable of giving. Now, I'm rather surprised that none of these ideas have emerged in your lecture, either with regard to your own philosophy or with regard to Rawls, because it seems to be such a deep underlying current in humanity, and yet we've come down to nothing but a sort of marketplace and optimizing the economic choice only.
Well, sorry, repeat question. Question is whether both I and Rawls don't place an excessive emphasis on market considerations and material rewards vis-a-vis the notion that people should do things for society out of a sense of social obligation or something. Well, I think that perhaps so, but I think I would want to distinguish myself from Rawls rather on this, in the sense that I think that he would argue that the only reason for giving someone some material advantage would be pour encourager les autres. I mean, that if you knew that it would never encourage anybody else to do anything to do anything of a similar kind, there would never be any reason for giving some reward to somebody. So that, I mean, if, as I think probably was the case, penicillin was discovered by a fluke, and you say, well, you know, we don't want to, that isn't going to encourage anybody to do anything in the future, and so therefore we won't bother to reward it. Whereas I'm arguing that this is not the only reason for ever providing differential rewards, and that we might simply want to give some people more than others because we think they deserve it. And if you like, that's a materialistic way of looking at things, in the sense, as you say, that we could say, well, no, simply we will praise people who who do things, who make contributions to society, and that will be it. I mean, let virtue be its own reward. I wouldn't myself be worried if that was so, but at the same time, I would feel myself that it's perfectly legitimate if people want to do this, to decide collectively to give some additional recognition of a material kind to people who have made outstanding contributions. And I wouldn't say that that is materialistic in the same way as the notion that the only reason for ever doing anything is in order to get people to do things. I mean, it seems to me this is a retrospective thing where you're saying, well, he did do it, and so we give him something for it.
I'd like to call on Dr. Peter Remnant, the head of philosophy at UBC, to thank the speaker.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, if I may use a slightly old-fashioned turn of phrase. I hope the audience will agree with me that Dr. Barry's talk admirably illustrates Spinoza's dictum that everything excellent is as difficult as it is rare. I hope you will also agree that the intensity with which the audience has followed this rather difficult piece of argumentation is a tribute to the intrinsic interest and importance of what Dr. Barry has had to say, and of the kind of inquiry that Dr. Barry is engaged in. In thanking him for you and for myself, I would like to also say that Dr. Barry has been on this campus now for the past 2 weeks and has spoken to many audiences, that many audiences and many who are here today, this evening, have been instructed and entertained by him, and that I would like to thank him, and I would hope you would join me in thanking him for the whole visit, his whole contribution here during the past 2 weeks, and to wish him well on his return.